Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the hottest internet radio show and podcast, The Authors Lab, a place for an eclectic and lively discussion of the dynamic world of writing, publishing, and marketing of the written word. I'm the sage and the host, Robert Batista. Follow me on Twitter at author R. Batista, and make it a point to follow The Authors Lab on Blog Talk Radio. Today, we are excited to have as our guest, lawyer and award-winning author of four masterful crime novels, Stephanie King. Stephanie, welcome to the Author's Lab.
Thanks for having me, Robert. I'm thrilled to be on your show.
It's a pleasure. So, Stephanie, let's start off by you giving us a synopsis of what your life as an artist and professional entails. Walk us through a day in your life.
Oh, I'm not sure you would want to walk with me through one of my days because I don't really have – I wish my process was a little more structured than it is. I basically try to get four or five good writing hours in a day.
Right.
And if I can do that, I consider myself lucky. I try to start out with something that physically stimulates me, like exercise, physical exercise. I can work through a lot of writing problems while I'm swimming, for instance. And then I tank up with a big glass of iced coffee, and I try to, hit the screen or the page, whatever phase I'm at in the writing.
So you mentioned writing problems, and that's a good thing that you did because so many authors listen to the show. Is it writer's block? Is it structure? Is it character? What exactly do you consider writer's problems?
Well, I don't really have writer's block as such because for most of my career I was a lawyer. And lawyers simply don't have that luxury of being blocked.
Right.
You have to respond, to deadlines and demands. And if you're doing trial law, which I did towards the end of my legal career, you've got to just be there in the moment and respond to what's going on. So writer's block is not so much a problem for me as it is finding the way into the story. And
Okay. What
makes me write, every book that I've written, they're all crime books. What makes me write is an itch. It's an idea or an issue that bothers me, that I want to explore through fiction and through characters who I make up. So I go through this very lengthy, and I realize most writers don't do this, or at least many don't. I go through this lengthy pre-writing phase where I'm figuring out what it is that bothers me and how I don't know where it's going to end up. It's just an idea, something, in the ether, something in the air, something maybe in current events, something, some idea that bothers me that I want to get on top of by writing about it. Finding the characters that get me into that story or that get me into that, that cluster of ideas, that's a big thing. And then, of course, as a former lawyer, I'm just completely obsessive about research. And in my newest book, A Perfect Eye, it's set in the art world. My previous ones were a lot easier because my heroine was a lawyer, and I knew that world well. But getting into the art world, I just had to do it was a huge, very steep learning curve for me. So there's the research phase. And then it's pulling it together into an engaging story. And, you know, frankly, that takes time. At least it takes me time.
I've been told, and I also go by the theory, that the most important parts of a story are the beginning, where you have to grab them in, and the ending, where you have to have a payoff. Now, a lot of authors already have the ending in mind before they finish the book, before they even sometimes write the book. They know how it's going to end. Are you that way?
I think that the end, the most important thing about the ending is it's got to circle back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So as I write, I mean, I do conceive before I actually start writing. I'm not a seat of the pants kind of writer. So I try to know where I'm going in my mind before I start
right.
to put words on a page. But then, you know, things change as you're writing it and the characters come alive and you're refining your sense of the setting and the, you know, the ideas that animated it. You can get to the end and realize that it's something different than what you imagined. So I sort of have it both ways. I start
right.
out with an idea of where I'm going, but then when I get there, it may not be where I thought it would be. But then the most important thing, though, is that it's unitary, that the story is a unit that somehow links back to the promise at the beginning.
Your career as an attorney seems quite interesting. Were you focused from the beginning on a law career, or did you just make that decision at a later stage?
Oh, no. Heavens, no. There are no lawyers in my family. In fact, there were no professionals in my family. So I kind of went into it. I had been a karate teacher, and I'd owned a karate studio, and actually we got sued, and, you know, and the realities of running a business in your early 20s, you know, really hit me pretty hard. And so I applied to law school. I didn't really have a plan for it. It just seemed like I wanted to continue my education. And because I'm absolutely hopeless with math and science, which many lawyers are, law seemed to be a viable path for me. And then I spent most of my – I got divorced after law school, and I ended up with, like, a ton of debts. And that drove me into a corporate law firm, which I absolutely had no – I mean, corporate law was, like, my least favorite course. I just didn't get into it at all. But I ended up in that environment because – I needed to pay some significant debts. After doing that for maybe 15 years, I had kind of an epiphany that I was dying in that practice. And I actually applied. I was inspired by friends of mine who had AIDS. And I realized that I was dying more than they were. They were physically dying, but I was just shrinking and, you know, spiritually dying, I guess you could say. And I applied to medical school. And to do that, I had to return to college and face all the courses that I had been so terrible at and that had driven me to law. So I had to, like, you know, take physics and chemistry, and they still didn't make any sense to me, but I, you know, I did it. And then I got rejected by, you know, every medical school I applied to. And that was actually the best experience I ever had, and it really is a great experience in terms of freeing me to write, because I had fallen on my face. You know, I just humiliated myself so badly in the course of, you know, trying to, this, in retrospect, this really sort of silly dream of being a doctor. And so anyway, I had to go back to the practice of law. And my old corporate firm, you know, didn't want me back because I wasn't a rainmaker. And so a criminal defense lawyer was the only one who would hire me. And he hired me for 10 or 15 bucks an hour, and he threw me into court. And it was the best that failure was the best experience I ever could have had, because it taught me not to be afraid of making a fool of myself. And
right.
In retrospect, that really was a great experience for becoming a writer.
Wow, what a fascinating story. Then you decide to delve, as you said, into the world of crime fiction. Talk about the germination of your first book and how was the transition from attorney to author? Were there any major speed bumps and challenges?
Well, actually, I think you know, attorneys have kind of an advantage. First of all, you don't have the writer's block because you're used to having to, you know, to just be there in the moment. But I think the biggest ingredient for a writer, I think, is curiosity. You know, when
right.
you walk down the street and you see a person, do you wonder what makes
what
them that way? You know, a complete stranger. Do you have curiosity about human beings and what makes them do the things that they do? You know, why is that guy frowning? What, you know, what's the deal with this couple? They look so disconnected. You know, just an instinctive curiosity. So I think that more than being a lawyer, just having that innate curiosity is the best predictor of whether you're going to be happy being a writer. As far as how I got into crime novels, I actually, the first book I wrote was a standalone crime novel called Quiet Time. And that was, I wrote that as sort of to have catharsis for a crime in which I was tangentially involved when I first got married when I was in college. So
right.
about 25 or 30 years had passed, and I had some involvement in that crime. It was the murder of a housewife in her garage in suburban Denver, and it happened 2 weeks before I was going to marry her son. So I knew the family well. The killer, or the man who was indicted for the murder, was my soon-to-be father-in-law. And on the day of the crime, he came to Boulder, where I was living with my fiancé, and, you know, in retrospect, tried to use us as an alibi. So it was a very, very traumatic event in my life.
Right.
You know, when I that marriage lasted about 10 years, and then I went and I was the good little corporate lawyer trying to pay the debts, and then I met my second husband, and he, you know, I told him about those events, and he said, well, don't you want to know what happened, you know, because my father-in-law was indicted, and then the charges were sort of mysteriously dropped on the eve of trial, and then nobody ever talked about it again. So I started researching, you know, what had actually happened, and that led me to write my first book, Quiet Time, which was, you know, a fictionalized version of that murder. And, you know, I felt catharsis from it. You know, I had no contact with any of those people. I wrote
right.
it under my second husband's name, which became my pen name, in order to distance myself. You know, I didn't want anything to come of it. And when I was promoting it, I never said that it was based on anything true. Then I went and wrote a bunch of other crime novels. And in 2005, I got a phone call from a cold case detective asking if I was the person who had written Quiet Time. Of course, he knew I was. And that book became instrumental in reopening what was by then like a 30-year-old cold case. My former father-in-law was reindicted for the murder, and I got kind of sucked into that case as a witness. So that kind of sidelined me for a few years. And it was actually how I wrote my first book. And the strange and interesting thing that came about as a result of it.
Well, let's talk about Quiet Time for a second. Besides, of course, the detective calling you, how was the feedback for that first novel, Quiet Time. How was it received?
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny you should ask that, because my publisher, Bantam, I was very upfront with them about the origins of the story. They ran it through their legal department, and they made me change every identifying detail, even to the point of changing the name Denver, you know, the city Denver, to Widmark,
right,
or something like that. And it changed because they made me move the timeline up 10 years. And I didn't, you know, I didn't buck them on any of that, because, like I said, I didn't want anything to come of it. You know, it was, to me, it was a fictional book, you know, and so it was okay that I did that. But I got some local reviewers. I got some reviews that said, well, I really liked the story, but I was so distracted by these obvious changes to, you know, obviously it took place in Denver. Why did she call it Widmark and stuff like that? Of course, you know, I couldn't respond to that. I mean, I just wrote, you know, thank you notes. Thank you. Thanks for the time you took reading the book. And I was itching to tell them, you know, I had a legitimate reason for doing that. But of course, I couldn't. So, and also the book came out like a week before 9/11. So it had a very short life and a quick death. And that's why,
wow,
it's so ironic that it actually is the one book that I wrote that went out into the world and did something. It had an effect, and the effect was bringing a killer to justice.
Wow, amazing. In your latest novel, The Perfect Eye, your protagonist is a lady called Lily Sparks, who has a fascinating gift. Talk about how you came up with this gem of a character.
Well, let me digress for one second and say that for some reason, I'm drawn to heroines who have unique perceptual traits.
Right.
And in the first three, I had a series of three crime books starring a criminal defense lawyer, a woman named Jackie Flowers. And Jackie was a dyslexic criminal defense lawyer who was a better lawyer because she couldn't read. So I've always been drawn to these heroines who kind of see the world through a different set of eyes. And the way I came up with Lily Sparks is I actually was inspired by a real human being, an art historian named Amy Herman, who has written a book called, I'm trying to find the title of it here, I think it's Visual Perception. And anyway, it's a book about how you can become more observant. And what Herman does is she takes medical students and lawyers and FBI agents and cops to museums to improve their diagnostic and investigatory skills by having them study paintings. So I thought, you know, what a fascinating skill set for a new kind of detective. So my heroine is hyper-observant. And, you know, being hyper-observant, of course, can have its downsides, as she discovered. It can actually be an Achilles heel if it blinds you to the meaning of what's right in front of you. I mean, you can take in all the data points, and they can distract you from what's actually happening.
Right, right. It can be almost like too much information.
Exactly. You see the trees and not the forest.
Exactly. The Perfect Eye, as you said, is set in the exciting world of art curators and forgeries. How is that you chose to set it in that type? I know you said you read the book, but what was the determining factor in you saying that you're going to set this story in that curators and forgery in the art world? And you mentioned research. And how much research did you have to do?
It was a really, really steep learning curve, because I'm one of these people who, I love art, but I go to a museum and I look at the paintings. I don't read the labels. I've never had any training in, I never even took an art appreciation course. So all I had was sort of an you know, a layperson's appreciation for art. But the world fascinated me because it's not so different from what writers do. And I decided that my bad guy would be a forger because one of the things I wanted to explore was the relationship between art and truth. And the real problem with forgery is that it's not art. It's fake. Art is alive, and forgery is just an imitation. And without an artist to copy, the forger is nobody. So I felt like that would be that a forger would be a really interesting vehicle to explore some of the, some of the themes, if you will, that I was interested in exploring. And then
I love,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I love the book's title. Did you have that title from the beginning, or did it take a while to come up with it?
Well, the title actually comes from how paintings are authenticated.
Okay.
It's estimated that 20% of art that's in museums is counterfeit. That means that when you walk into a museum, 1 out of 5 paintings on the wall is a fake. It's a forgery.
Wow.
It's not by the person who it purports to be by. So if a painting doesn't have an impeccable chain of title, meaning you can trace who owned it from the time the artist painted it, then to authenticate a painting depends on an expert's eye, a so-called perfect eye, a connoisseur, you know, an expert's opinion. And nowadays, you know, you read about all these scientific tests that paintings are subjected to see if they're forgeries.
Right.
But really adept forgers can acquire period materials. You can get canvases that are hundreds of years old that you can paint over at flea markets in Europe. Some forgers can make period authentic inks by boiling acorns. I mean, they can defeat a lot of the scientific tests, and then it depends on the expert. And it's said that to foist a forgery on the art world, you really just have to convince one expert, and he'll do the rest of the work for you. That's because experts have tons of hubris and ego, which makes them dig in their heels and can blind them to the truth. So a perfect eye was sort of a play on both, you know, the hubris of the connoisseur, which is who the forger wants to trick and prove that he's smarter than. So there was that aspect of it. And there was also Lily Sparks's training in being hyper-observant. So it had sort of a double meaning.
I think the title is brilliant. And in your book, Stephanie, do you identify more with the heroine or villain, and why?
Well, I've found that in crime writing, if you can identify with the villain, you have struck gold. Because the villain is the engine that drives the plot. So two things made the bad guy, who was a forger, turn killer in a perfect eye. Two things made him personal for me. First of all, he reminded me of a certain client I'd represented when I was a lawyer. And as a writer, I also identified with him. So my most difficult client was a con man. A con man's gratification is duping a sucker. They'd rather take $10 from you than make $100 honestly, even if it took the same effort. And wanting to believe in your clients makes the lawyer a prime mark. That client also stiffed me on my feet. So he's, you know, I've never forgotten him. But more than that, there's the plight of the writer. Anyone who wants to be published, and you know this as a writer yourself, anyone who wants to be published seesaws between grandiosity on the one hand and humiliation and despair on the other.
How true.
Now, what makes a forger tick is they don't do it for the money. They do it to prove the experts wrong. So what writer can't identify with someone who wants to prove his critics or the publishing industry wrong? So once I had those twin factors of repulsion and identification, I could bring the villain alive.
To me, each one of your four novels is a masterpiece of standalone, unique in its plot and characters. So tell me, Stephanie, where does a crime novelist's greatest creative effort go?
Well, it goes into creating the bad guy, because he is the one that drives the plot. And in this case, like I was saying, well, first of all, a well-constructed bad guy has to have an internal tension. And what fascinated me about forgers is, like I said, they don't do it for the money. They do it to prove the experts wrong. In other words, that they're smarter than the experts who have rejected them. But once they succeed, something new kicks in. Now they want recognition. They want to have their cake, and they want to eat it too. And that's what leads to their downfall. So I think, you know, it's obviously it's very important to have a protagonist who you know, you can identify with and you can bring alive. But I think that, you know, to make a really good crime story, you have to have a somebody who is on the other side of the protagonist. The antagonist or the bad guy has to be even better than the protagonist or the heroine, because that gives the heroine something that they've got to up their game to beat. So my greatest effort goes into the bad guy.
Yeah, sort of like Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty, where the bad guy is, you know, just brilliant, you know, and you can't stop reading about him or take your eyes off of him. So switching gears, Stephanie, looking back, what were some of the books that affected you most when you were in school? And did you have any favorite authors?
Well, when I was in school, I kind of liked, you know, this sounds so strange, but I loved the Iliad. I loved that, you know, I loved Greek mythology. I loved those sort
Homer.
Of, yeah, I loved the language of it, although I'm certainly not a poet. That really somehow got deep into my bones. I don't know why. On the other end of the spectrum, I absolutely loved Alfred Hitchcock. I read Alfred Hitchcock's magazine madly when I was a child. They were just masterful short stories, and I got a sense of story and plot, and beginning and middle and end. From reading those short stories. I also read a lot of science fiction, frankly, and that sort of built in me or instilled in me the, you know, this wonder of worlds, you know, of building a world that was a way to look at our world, but from another world, if that makes sense.
In a time where hundreds of thousands of books are published every year in so many different types of platforms, so many authors want to know how they can make their book stand out from all the rest. How do you handle this? How do you handle the marketing aspect of being an author?
It is the worst part of it for me. It is very difficult to wear two such different hats. You know, publishers are not known for courage. They have one goal, which is selling books. And when it comes to selling your book, whether you're trying to sell it to an agent or, you know, ultimately a publishing company, you face the conundrum of wanting to be read to communicate what you care about, and at the same time trying to convince strangers to care about it too. So I think, you know, actually, the worst writing advice I've ever heard, and this is in retrospect, you know, it certainly didn't strike me that way at the time, but looking back for 15 years, I think the worst and most dangerous writing advice that young writers get is to write with the reader in mind. Every writer wants to be read, which means on some level you have to be entertaining. But if you're also writing to explore an idea or some personal truth, if you're writing with some hypothetical reader in mind, you risk losing the very thing that drove you to write. So I think writers should, the best advice should be to keep asking yourself why you want to write. And that answer may change throughout your career. But you have to be straight with yourself. And the rewards have to be built into the writing itself, not into what happens to your book in the marketplace.
So, do you have a social media platform?
I do, and it's pretty new because I'm the stereotypical hermit introvert writer. So to promote A Perfect Eye, I've always had a website. I've had a website for about 15 years, although it recently got completely revamped because of A Perfect Eye. And to promote A Perfect Eye, I've started to write a blog, and I'm also on Facebook. But those are very, very new platforms to me. I'm very, very selfish and careful about guarding my creative energy.
Right.
So I try to, when I do that stuff, I try to do it in a lump. You know, I try to bank it up so that I can free myself to go back to writing a manuscript, which requires even more creative energy. So I try to really, you know, manage my energy that way, and I'm not on Twitter. I'm told by everybody under the sun that I should be. But frankly, you know, there are just so many distractions in the world today. It's very hard to protect your energy, your creative energy.
In closing, what's next for Stephanie Kane? What new irons do you have in the fire coming up? A movie deal, possibly?
I just want people to be able to read A Perfect Eye. And I'd like to keep writing more Lily Sparks books. I have a couple in mind. And my goals are pretty modest. And that's one thing that I've learned in 15 years of being in the publishing industry is that your goals should be put into writing what you care about. Right, as you know as a writer, writing is hard. It's very, very hard to develop an idea into a book length piece of work. And that's where I try to put my ego and my goals, and not into, you know, how the market may respond to it. Because therein truly lies madness.
Well, let me tell you, I went online and on Amazon and took a look at the plots of each one of your books, each one of your stories, and every one of them, in my estimation, would make a fantastic film. Excuse me, but that's me. I think each one, the plot is so brilliant, it would make a great movie, but I guess that'll be on the next show. So if people want to get in contact with you, Stephanie, can you give out your website address and any other contact info?
I'm thrilled to do so. I have a Facebook page. It's an author's page. It's Stephanie Kane, K-A-N-E. And I have a website, writerkane.com. That's writerkane.com. And my blog is on there.
This has been the Author's Lab with me, Robert Batista. My mission is to give creative people a platform to show you who they are. One of my short stories, My Baby Has No Name, can be read for free online at spillwords.com. My guest has been Stephanie Kane. Make sure you pick up her latest potboiler, A Perfect Eye. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for being my guest on The Office Lab.
Thank you, Robert. It was a pleasure.
It was wonderful. Have a great rest of the day.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. This is Robert Batista signing off with this little rhyme. Today is yesterday's tomorrow. Though each one may bring joy or sorrow, God's message is clear to those with sight. Through darkness always comes the light.